From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Controversy surrounding this week's opening of the movie Predator. One of the film's stars, Olivia Munn, complained about the casting of a registered sex offender in one of her scenes. The studio removed the scene after it was shot, but it raises the question of whether those with sex offender pass should be cast in feature films, and if so, should their castmates be informed? We'll talk about that after our political roundup.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. I had a nice weekend. I sure hope you did and that you're raring to go this week as we start out getting updated on the biggest stories in news as we do every Monday. We kick off by focusing on the top political news, and there have been a few big stories that have taken place over the past several days. President Obama spoke in Orange County trying to get out the vote for the midterm elections, and Democrats, of course, trying to flip a number of those in-play congressional districts in Orange County. He spoke in Illinois on Friday, and in fact, the president there, in what is a breach of typical presidential protocol, took direct aim at the Trump administration and Republicans, he said, were unwilling to stand up to Trump.
In a healthy democracy, there's some checks and balances on this kind of behavior, this kind of inconsistency. But right now, there's nothing. Republicans who know better in Congress, and they're there, they're quoted saying, yeah, we know this is kind of crazy, are still bending over backwards to shield this behavior from scrutiny or accountability or consequence. Seem utterly unwilling to find the backbone to safeguard the institutions that make our democracy work.
Now, over the weekend, the president seemed to tone down his rhetoric just a little bit. Former President Obama, nonetheless, making an impassioned plea for Democrats to turn out. Joining us is Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor of politics, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, founder of Rodriguez Strategies of L.A. Jack, let me start with you and your sense of President Obama's Illinois speech, where he went very directly against the administration, and then his tone over the weekend here.
This is what one would expect in a midterm campaign. You want to take on the other party, and Democrats have been waiting a very long time for President Obama to confront President Trump very directly, and that he did in Illinois. What he did in Anaheim was tout the virtues of the Democratic candidates, and that's something you also have to do, too. It's not just a matter of telling people they have to vote against something. You have to give them something to vote for. And so in his remarks, he went over each of the candidates on stage very directly, and the tone was overall positive. So it makes sense, even though the attack on Trump was unusual in its directness and severity.
Matt, what are your thoughts about President Obama taking on his successor?
It's pretty rare. You know, a lot of the successful, typically when you leave office, presidential numbers tend to rise. And that's often because presidents either go away, George W. Bush, Reagan to some degree, or they invest themselves in something different. Jimmy Carter is a classic case. He struggled. He had not a particularly successful presidency, but he's held in enormous regard. Habitat for Humanity, his work around the world on both foreign relations as well as nonprofits. And even Clinton, to a degree, he got caught back up in the political maelstrom when his wife was running twice for president, but he did done a lot of good work. Obama's kind of been gone, and his numbers have been raised, and now he's back in attacking Trump. I think we're in a time of norms. Nobody cares about the norms any longer, so why would the next president go after a sitting president at this point? I do think I'm kind of curious to see how this will play out. This is classic. This entire midterm in the same way that 2010 and 2014. This is all about, those were about Obama. This is all about Trump. And that no one's hiding that. This is what it's all going to be. They'll have the obligatory events that he's going to go to. I thought it was a little weird. They had these seven, they show them up on stage. There's seven of them there. It looked like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs kind of thing. Like, it, which, you know, is fine. You hope that he's going to boost turnout a little bit. I think the die is probably mostly cast for this election. I don't know how much of the Obama being out there is going to make that big of a difference. If you're a candidate, you want him to come. It'll get you some press. It's good.
Sure.
How much he's going to really drive turnout. We've already seen turnout high in a lot of these special elections, the off-year elections. I don't know if people are going to be like, oh, I really need to get out there because Barack Obama is out on the trail. But it does provide a lot of fodder for a press that's been waiting for this for a while.
I'm struck how much the norm has shifted. Had President Obama 4 years ago, if this whole thing, you know, and it had made the comments he did in Illinois, people just like, oh, my goodness. But they're so measured compared to what we've gotten used to from President Trump that what Obama said in Illinois seemed mild. But it wouldn't have seemed mild a few years
ago. No, and could you imagine if Bush had done that, say, in the 2010? People would have had a meltdown. But that's how much Trump has really moved the goalposts in terms of his rhetoric and the way he operates. And you saw even Obama, I thought, struggling though to really lay a glove in terms of what, you know, what the argument is against Trump. Is it the norms that are being broken? Well, the economy is good. Well, I started the economy. Actually, he's taking too much credit for it. And you can see how difficult it is to kind of go after. There's a lot to go after Trump on, but you sort of end up flailing around because there just seems like there are so many targets to hit. And I thought that was a little bit going on in his Illinois speech.
Jack Pitney, your thoughts about which voters are going to be most apt to turn out who might not have otherwise with former President Obama showing up. Is there a particular segment that he might actually get out who wouldn't otherwise come?
I think it's right that you can't put too much emphasis on Obama's appeal. There's only so much a speech can do that only so much a former president can do. A lot of this is going to be about Trump, and Trump is motivating to groups of voters who often do not turn out in high numbers, particularly among young people. I can see this in talking to my own students. Even students who otherwise might be leaning Republican are leaning Democratic this time, and all of that is due to Donald Trump. When it comes to a popularity contest, Obama does have something of an advantage. A few months ago, Gallup asked voters retrospectively to rate presidential performance, and 63% said they approved of the way Barack Obama handled his job in office. As of this morning, Donald Trump's approval rating is 40%. So if I were betting, I'd rather bet on the side that has 63% approval than 40% approval.
We're talking with Professor of Government at Claremont McKenna College, Professor of Politics Jack Pitney, Matt Rodriguez, former senior Obama advisor in 2008. Rodriguez Strategies is his firm. Matt, the economic numbers are frankly terrific,
right.
And the Trump administration is touting those numbers.
Yeah.
We're seeing a jobless rate that is impressively low. Wages are now starting to rise. In fact, there are concerns that there might be some inflation that come out of rising wages and increasing spending by Americans. And we had, as was just mentioned, President Obama saying, hey, this really started on my watch through my policies. How big a factor do you think this is going to be in the midterms?
Well, it could have been a bigger one if Trump had any discipline. If you're a Republican, you must watch this and just, like, at one level be excited and also be like, if we had just talked about this for the entire year, we might be in a bit better shape. What's interesting about Trump and the way he approaches the economy, it goes back to the contrast between Obama and Trump. Obama, during his entire 8 years, was very ginger in terms of how he talked about it. He would always approach it very carefully. He would tout that more jobs were coming, growth was picking up, but he was always like, we have a lot more to do. He didn't want to say too much. There was always a fear that there was going to be some regression and that it was going to fall to him. And that was sort of the old norms of politics. Don't take too much credit for the economy, but take as much as you can. And Trump, of course, just sort of dives right into the tank and says, I'm responsible for all of this. All of that said, look, the numbers are pretty remarkable. You're talking about 4+% growth, rising wages. I think the administration is finally starting to lean into it. I think it might be a little bit late because I think voters are kind of forming whatever their opinions are. But it does make you wonder if Trump had really focused just on an economic message with how the economy is doing, if he'd focused more on infrastructure, had spent less time on some of the divisive issues, might he be in a bit of a different place? Who knows? Some of the divisive issues that he was going after, the border wall, the flight travel ban, that also there's a certain part of his base that wanted that as well. So it's always hard to pick apart what was or wasn't the right strategy. But if you're a Republican House or Senate member, you clearly would you want to be talking about these numbers, and you don't want to be talking about anonymous op-eds, Bob Woodward's book, Chaos in the White House. How much Republicans can really zone in on that and make a difference over the course of the next 2 months, I don't know.
Well, especially for Republicans, you know, in Congress, they'd want to be making the arguments, look, it's deregulation that created a more stable environment for businesses,
tax cuts.
They're wanted from an ideological perspective.
Yeah.
That's the case they want to make to voters above and beyond an individual candidate.
Well, and this is a big argument. They've gotten a lot of white working class voters, lower educated folks into their tent over the course of the last 20 or 30 years. And there is a philosophical discussion, right? Democrats are always saying people who are making $50,000 a year, let's say, they're voting against their self-interest. Why are they voting for Republicans? Republicans don't care about them. I've never liked that message because it sort of implies you're dumb and why are you voting for someone you shouldn't be voting for. That's a separate political point of privilege of mine. But there is an economic argument to say, no, our policies are helping you. And the fact that Republicans aren't, as opposed to what the Democrats are going to do. So the fact that they're not completely free to make that case because there's a Trump tweet of the day is, I think, must be frustrating for them.
Yeah. Jack Pitney, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Trump can't help himself. Matt's right. If all they talked about were the economy, they'd be in better shape. But Trump's rule of thumb is always respond to an attack. Never let an attack go unanswered. When he was in New York City in business, that might have been a very sensible approach. It makes no sense when he's president, when he has a lot of good economic news to talk about. Every time he's talking about Woodward, that's a time he's not using to talk about the economy. The other thing that he does that undercuts his own message is he has perfectly good numbers to talk about, but he still can't help himself. He makes stuff up. He makes false claims about the economy. For instance, he made a very strange one today about the unemployment rate being lower than GDP growth. That he said that's never happened. Of course, that's happened dozens of times. And so he undercuts his credibility when he does that. If all he did were just read the talking points that his staff puts in front of him, he'd be in better shape.
Where
but he's constitutionally unable to do that.
Jack, where do you think he gets this stuff?
Fox News. He hears things, or at least half hears things on Fox News, repeats it without vetting them. Very often he'll just say whatever comes to his into his head or something he hears, and he just repeats it, and he doesn't really bother to check it out. Again, when he was in private business, that might have been an approach that didn't do him too much harm. But when you're president, every word weighs a ton, and a lot of those tons are dropping on his head right now.
Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, joining us on Air Talk. We, of course, have the confirmation hearings last week for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Much that we covered on that last week, but I did want to briefly hear from each of you. Matt, your thoughts on it? You see anything that would derail the confirmation?
No. I thought that there were a lot of histrionics. Not surprisingly, Democrats need to play to a base. Republicans are just trying to get this nomination and over the top. I thought Kavanaugh handled himself about as well as you could. He's clearly qualified. So this gets back to the, do presidents have the prerogative to put somebody up and elections have consequences? And so I think there was a lot of drama around the hearing and around him. But he himself is really not a dramatic person. Right? He's clearly qualified. The American Bar Association came out with its highest rating for him. So you basically, from a Democratic strategic perspective, get reduced to saying, here are all the things that will happen if he's on the court because Trump is so bad. But Trump is the president. And so I didn't see anything that's really going to materially change this. And my guess is once he is confirmed, as much drama and as much press as was made, I doubt this is going to be much of an issue moving forward. I think he's going to get on there. We're going to forget there are even hearings in about 3 weeks.
I think I saw there was a progressive group that's raised $800,000 to try and pressure Susan Collins to vote against the confirmation. They said they'll give it to the, you know, opponent of her if she doesn't vote against the confirmation.
Yeah. But abortion is really but again, this is also no one's really been able to find exactly where the target is on Kavanaugh. Right. At first it was abortion, and then they were sort of doing presidential power. We're not getting documents. Democrats have tried a variety of things to try to really see if anything really, really sticks. Nothing has really stuck to him. And again, he acquitted himself reasonably well in the sense that he got asked questions. No one answers them anyway in the modern era. So it wasn't like you were going to get a lot of answers from him. But he's clearly a qualified judge, whatever you consider qualified. So it's going to be hard to stop.
Jack Pitney, your thoughts on anything that would derail confirmation for Kavanaugh?
I suppose if there were some revelation that he were a cat burglar that comes out in the next couple of days, that might do something. But short of some bizarre revelation such as that, he's on track. It would be an enormous shock if Collins or Murkowski voted against him. The only real suspense is whether there will be any Democrats who vote for him. There's some speculation that some of the red state Democrats who are up for re-election this year might decide to vote for him. But in the end, it probably is not going to be decisive. It's really hard to find too many Senate elections over history that were decided by a vote on the Supreme Court.
Coming up, we'll talk about the election in Sweden over the weekend, where the Swedish Democrats, who were a right-wing group, had their best showing ever. We'll talk about the issue of immigration that was at the forefront of that election. Also, several days after the release of excerpts of Bob Woodward's book on the Trump administration, we'll talk about what sort of effect that's having. And the announcement this morning that the Trump administration is closing the PLO's office in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Air Talk, our weekly political roundup on 89.3. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, we'll take a look at the new film Predator, which opens this week. A 3-minute scene from the film has been deleted after a complaint was made by actor Olivia Munn, one of the co-stars of the film. The scene included her with an actor who is a registered sex offender. Munn found out about that status, complained to Fox, which was making the movie, and they pulled the scene. We'll talk about what it means to hire someone who's on the sex offender registry, whether you would be comfortable working with someone who is a registered sex offender and has done time for such an offense, and also what the law says about employing someone who is a registered sex offender. We continue, though, with our political conversation we do each week. Joining us, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor of politics. There have been a number of reports that members of the Trump administration met with senior leaders of the Venezuelan military to talk about a possible coup. Jack, your thoughts, first of all, on the conversation, but the fact that someone would leak that.
Well, this is related to the Woodward story that this is an administration that leaks, even when it comes to issues of national security, that the Trump administration is considering doing something in Venezuela is really consistent with what we already knew. Trump openly talked about a so-called military option, and there were reports that he was privately talking about an invasion. And this is the kind of thing that the people around him are very worried about. This is the kind of attitude that gave rise to the anonymous letter. The people who are in the White House worried that Trump is going to do something very rash. That said, the idea of the United States supporting coups in the Americas is not a new one. This goes back decades, Guatemala in the 1950s and so on. Mm-hmm. But this story is probably, to put it mildly, not good for the American image in Central and South America.
Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, this at a time when the United States is complaining about Russia interfering in our elections. We're talking about going into, and Jack is right, you know, Chile. You can just go down the list in terms of South America, Latin America. So there is a very questionable and certainly controversial history of what the United States has done going really back about 100 years or so. And so I don't know where this is all going to go. The leaks are really problematic. This is a very disturbing leak. One, because, I mean, the idea of going to Venezuela, that sounds like a disaster.
Yeah,
to me.
It's two issues.
It's two disasters.
One of which is the meeting. The second is that then it was leaked.
Are we really going into we're meeting with these? I mean, there's so many areas that are problematic. But the fact that these types of things leak to CNN is just particularly concerning. And it's not like this came out, you know, a year or two later when there's a little bit of distance. I mean, so it is, or 10 years later, I should say. So these things are a little bit concerning the way this administration operates. And coming off of what happened last week with all the people talking to Woodward or, you know, anonymous sources and then denying it and then the anonymous op-ed, you really got to wonder what kind of ship this guy's running here. It's concerning.
So there have been reports this morning that the U.S. government is looking to close the PLO office in D.C. Matt, what's the significance of that?
Well, it doesn't totally shock me. Look, this has been a very pro-Israel administration. Trump has been very, very hawkish on it for a while. He's got John Bolton in there, who's a big hawk. So it doesn't totally shock me whether it's a good move or not. I mean, the peace process is just – this is a one in a long line of events that go back, you know, decades, the United States has gotten in the middle of. I don't know where this is going to go. I think there'll be the usual people lining up just because Trump did it. They're going to be upset about it. Some will see it as a good move. I think Trump is he's clearly made the decision. He's going to go all in on the Israel side, and pretty much whatever they do, they're going to be there. We saw today that Bolton was looking at even bringing some kind of charges against the criminal court because they're looking at having some investigations of Israel and their tactics around the Palestinians. So it's a never-ending saga that is Israel and the Palestinian Authority. You know, where this is going to lead, it's hard to tell. The Trump administration seems to float in and out of this in terms of the Israel thing. They seem to want to show their hawkish strength, but it doesn't seem like there's any real effort being made at the peace process. It just seems that they use the Israeli Palestinian conflict when it suits their political needs. For whatever reason, they decided to do this today.
Jack, what do you think? And obviously, it has strong symbolic significance, but more than that.
Well, that's the key word, symbolism. Is there a strategy here? Is there an end game? Trump's defenders will say, well, this is all part of a grand strategy to encourage the Palestinians to negotiate in good faith. If that's the case, arguably it could be something that works out. But I tend to doubt that. After all, this is a president who decided to initially give the Middle East portfolio to Jared Kushner, who is not known as a foreign policy expert. So my guess is, rather than being part of some grand strategy, this is something that Trump thought would be popular. And in the short run, that might work for him. But in the long run, that tends not to be a prudent approach to foreign policy.
We also have from Sweden a fascinating political result there, where the right-wing Sweden Democrats had their best showing ever. I believe it was 17% of the vote. This really gets to the issue of immigration, because Sweden has been among the most, if not the most, embracing of refugees coming into the country. That has created a backlash, which at least in part benefits the Sweden Democrats. Matt, your sense how a country as pro-refugee, yeah, pro-immigration as Sweden, yeah, is now rethinking that.
But also very homogenous country culturally. In some ways, they got a little bit, Sweden Democrats got a little bit less than originally was anticipated. There was some thought for a while they might get upwards of 20%, which was really causing consternation. I would say a couple of things. One is, and you know, this is a European issue, these are much more homogenous countries culturally. And so there's been, you know, you saw it with Germany, you saw the backlash now with Sweden. Trying to assimilate large numbers of refugees has been a challenge for them politically. It also gets back to some of the nationalist leanings that we've seen around the world, including in this country, that Trump sort of touched on that a little bit, and he was successful. And there's just some general questions around the economic, you know, what are the economic there's not only the cultural piece, but what are the economic losses that come with large numbers of refugees? Does it put pressure on wages? Is there fewer jobs? Those are all things that are roiling over over in Sweden right now. Final thing I would say is this is also a longer-term issue that is happening in Europe, and it's happening in the United States. It's really happening in Western democracies, which is the difficulty of coalition governments to come together. You're seeing the Sweden Democrats didn't have a huge win, but it was larger than they've ever had before, and you're seeing some of the far left and far right sections of the parties gaining. They're not taking over, but they are gaining, and they're weakening the sort of more establishment figures in the establishment parties. And this is just another example of that. We've seen it in this country. There's just a weakening of the establishment that's gone, that has kind of held up the world order for 50, 60, 70 years now. And Sweden is not immune to that, and that is what we're starting to see here. Now, where this is going to go, we're going to have to watch that play out. But that is, I think, some of the factors that are playing into what's going on there and in a lot of other countries around the world.
Yeah. Jack, how do you see it?
Well, it's not just Sweden. This is, in varying degrees, something that all the countries in Europe have to deal with. In France, you had the historic relationship with Algeria, which in turn was related to a very large Islamic population. You have troubles in Germany. You've got conflicts in Britain. So this is a story that's going to wax and wane throughout Europe. I even noticed this this past summer in Ireland. We tend to think of Ireland as being just all white Catholic, but in fact, there's a good deal of cultural conflict in Ireland, an increasingly diverse population. So the story in Sweden is part of a much broader tableau.
I'm just watching right now John Bolton, National Security Advisor to the President, making the formal announcement that the administration will close the Palestine Liberation Office in D.C. So that is official. Let me share a couple listener comments. Tony writes on the page, Sweden used to be homogenous, no more. They're learning about diversity the hard way. And JSK writes on the page, last November, Pew reported that in 2016, Sweden had the second largest Muslim share of their population in Europe after France at 8%. They projected under the high immigration scenario, the Muslim population of Sweden would grow to more than 30% by 2050. Native Swedes, this is JSK writing, are highly secular, have low birth rates. Muslims are the opposite. That's JSK writing on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We also have a news conference in Sacramento taking place right now, in which Governor Jerry Brown signed the bill that mandates that California must have all renewable energy electricity generation by 2045. So the governor signed that bill. Now, there are no penalties if the state doesn't reach that all renewable by 2045, but it's a clear statement of intent that the state does not intend to have any fossil fuel production of electricity by the year 2045. So the governor is signing that bill in advance of a climate conference that's coming to California with some of the top clients, science climatologists coming to California. We continue with the Bob Woodward book and the unsigned New York Times op-ed, both of which detail people within the Bush White House working against the president's agenda in cases where they believe the agenda is a danger to the country. Jack, what are your thoughts about this? And are you concerned about a precedent that people following their own conscience, making this kind of a determination?
It is a dilemma. On the one hand, you don't want unelected officials thwarting the constitutionally selected president. That's not the way the system should work. On the other hand, if a president looks like he's going to do something really, really rash and intervention might stop that, you can sort of understand the motivation. So that's the dilemma facing people in the White House. The question, of course, is whether the person who wrote the article in the New York Times should come forward. Now, those who say he should, and the reports are that it is a male, say that the honorable thing to do is to resign in protest. And there are others who say, well, if this is a person who is in a position to prevent catastrophe, well, maybe that person ought to remain in place. And this is a debate we're going to have for the at least the next several days, at least until something else comes along.
Matt, just real quickly, you know, people who are critical of President Trump sort of rolled their eyes when Trump told Jeff Sessions that the Justice Department should investigate to find that. I was trying to put that in the opposite context, though. If you had a Democratic president, someone saying that they were, you know, intentionally working against trying to undermine the president, you'd probably have a lot of Democrats who would say the Justice Department should try and find out who that person is.
Obama prosecuted more went after more leakers than any president in history. A lot of this depends on whose ox is getting gored. We talked about this last week. I think this is a very disturbing development. I thought it was irresponsible what the New York Times did to publish this. And I think that you cannot have people out there saying, I just don't agree with what the president is doing, and here's what I'm doing to stop it. And if it were serious, we talked about this last week, but also if there was something specific in the op-ed that the president was looking to nuke, you know, North Korea, and we stopped him. One, that's a real constitutional crisis, but they should have done something on that. But this was just a general kind of, he's a crazy person and I'm stopping him for all of you. I don't think that's enough of a rationale to make such a breach of what our democratic and constitutional system is.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both very much. Matt Rodriguez, Rodriguez Strategies, Democratic Strategist, and Jack Pitney, Professor of Politics, Claremont McKenna College. Thank you both so much for joining us. Coming up, we're going to talk about controversy surrounding the release of the new film Predator, directed by Shane Black. One of the stars of the film, Olivia Munn, complained to the studio that made the movie when she found out one of her fellow actors with whom she did a scene is a registered sex offender. We'll talk about the implications in workplace law right after this live update from Hedy Lyn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great start to your day. Stay tuned. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to talk about a high school football game which had much more going on than just the battle on the field. It was the matchup Friday night between Santa Ana High School and Aliso Niguel. The game was played at Aliso Niguel. And the principal at Santa Ana High took issue with some of the signs that were held up, felt they were racist intimidation of the students at his almost exclusively Latino school. We'll talk about that coming up in our second hour. But first, the sequel Predator, starring Olivia Munn, is going to be in theaters this weekend. But the film is arriving with a bit of controversy. Late last week, Fox, which made the picture, pulled a three-minute scene between Olivia Munn and actor Steven Wilder Striegel. This after Munn found out that Striegel is a registered sex offender. He had served 6 months' time after pleading guilty to conduct which involved sexually explicit text messages with a 14-year-old girl. So Fox pulled the scene from the film. Munn said that she was unhappy that she hadn't been informed about the status of her fellow actor. And the director, Shane Black, who is a friend of Striegel and cast him in his film, The Predator, came out with an apology to Munn. He also said he wasn't aware of the extent of the actions that were alleged with which Steven Wilder Striegel was involved. So the question is, what legally can employers do in cases like this if someone is a registered sex offender? Can an employer totally exclude someone from that basis? If they hire someone who is a registered sex offender, should the company tell the co-workers that the person is on the register, or would that be a violation of the law to do so? So it's the issue of the employment rights of a convicted sex offender who is on the registry versus the feelings of those in the workplace who might not want to work with someone on the registry. I welcome your calls about this. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. With me is Chair of the Employment Law Group at Duane Morris LLP in San Francisco, Robert Issa. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So in a case like this, my understanding is that Fox Studios said, we are not able to do a background check like that to find out this kind of information on a prospective actor or anyone else involved in film production. Is that accurate?
Well, it's accurate to a degree, and it's actually inaccurate to a different degree. So what he's referring to, or what they're likely referring to, is can they access the sex offender registration register and see this person's name and use that information? In other words, access Megan's Law, find this person's name, and review that for purposes of the employment relationship. The answer is no. Specifically, cannot do that pursuant to the statute. What they can do, though, is they can perform an otherwise lawful criminal background check by going through very careful rules and regulations and the protocols about what they are able to do. They have to notify the individual they're doing that. They've got to give them a report afterwards. They can only go back for 7 years. There's lots of procedural steps they have to take. But they can do criminal background checks, but they just must be lawful. They cannot access the Megan's Law sexual offender registry.
Now, in this case, the guilty plea was in 2010. So it sounds like if it only goes back 7 years, they would not have been able to use this conviction.
That is correct.
Okay. So then Fox would be correct in saying that they were not able to use this to exclude Striegel's employment?
That is correct.
Okay. And so by a further extension of that, they would not have been legally able, if they did find it out, to tell Striegel's coworkers, or if someone brings it to their attention— can they legally share, hey, you know, we can't exclude this person, but you should know that 8 years ago they pled guilty to a sex offense?
Okay, so now the law gets a little bit gray. And you have to understand first that under California law, there's a legal presumption that employment is at will. What at will means is that you can be terminated with or without notice and with or without cause for any reason, so long as it's not based on an unlawful protected right. You can't terminate someone because of their height or their religion or their race or their creed. But you can terminate them for any other reason so long as it's not in violation of a protected trait. So in this instance, if it came to their attention that this individual was a sex offender and they wanted to make a decision to terminate him because they didn't like the fact that he was a sex offender, they could have done that under the at-will provision, because sex offense is not a protected class, and they could have done that if they so chose.
And they could do that with any crime if someone was convicted of a drug offense or assault with a deadly weapon. They could essentially for any reason, as long as it's not a protected status, let someone go.
Right, that's correct, with a little caveat. The law in this area is changing, and it's evolving. And recently, effective this year, you may have heard of the comment, ban the box.
Yes.
It is now unlawful for an employer to ask a prospective applicant or an employee if they've ever been convicted of any crime. They cannot ask that question any longer. However, what they can do is after they make an employment decision to hire the individual, they can then go back and say, now I want to do some additional background work and determine whether or not they have been convicted of any crimes or any other activity which would affect their ability to do a job for us. And they have a discretionary call to make. Now, if they do that additional background check and they make a decision not to hire the individual, that individual can then question it and say, I want to know the real reasons why and the specifics. And then they can challenge that with the California Fair Employment and Housing Division and claim that it's an improper form of discrimination, because they've done their duty, they've served their time, and now it's unlawful to not give them a job simply because of a conviction which had no immediate impact on the job.
So it sounds like potentially Striegel would have had that redress available if he determined he was turned down for the role because of his time served and being on the sex registry. Just taking the scene out of the film, a studio can do that, of course. He's presumably not lost his pay, so I don't think there's any question legally about what the studio has done. But I'm asking hypothetically, could they have turned him down for the job because of his past legal status?
And that's the question that's in the gray area right now. They certainly have the right not to terminate him, but they have to connect it to the job. So in other words, they've got to be able to say, we did this in order to protect a person or a population which we believe may have been at risk. You are permitted to do that. And then it becomes a question of fact, were there people really at risk? Was this really legitimate? Was this in good faith? Was it done for the right reason?
So if there were minors in the cast, for example, that would presumably make the studio's hand stronger in denying work.
Absolutely, without any question.
All right. We're talking with employment law specialist Robert Issa. I welcome your calls. I'd like to hear, if you are on the sex offender registry, how have you seen that play out in your search for jobs? And have you been explicitly turned down for work because you are a registered sex offender? Or was it discovered after you started working at a particular job? And how was that handled with your coworkers and with your employer? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'm also interested in your thoughts. If you are an employer, what would you think about hiring someone who is a registered sex offender and has served time for that offense? Under what conditions would you, if ever, hire that person? And would you disclose that to the person's coworkers? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about the case of, the actor Steven Wilder Striegel, who had a small role in the upcoming film The Predator. It's part of the series of Predator films. This one, Shane Black directing and wrote, and Black is a friend of Striegel, cast him in the film, and then co-star Olivia Munn found out after filming an about 3-minute scene with Striegel that Striegel is a registered sex offender. Going back a number of years ago, he pled guilty to exchanging sexually explicit text messages with a 14-year-old who was an extended member of his family. And so he pled guilty. He served 6 months' time, was released, required to register as a sex offender. So this raises the issue of how it's treated under California employment law and what the implications are for those not just casting films, but hiring someone who is on the sex offender registry. And what rights do coworkers have to learn of that status or not of someone working with them? Olivia Munn, who made her complaint to Fox Studio, they pulled that scene after she made her concerns clear. But she clearly did not want to work with someone who was a registered sex offender in this case. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Again, if you are on the sex offender registry, I'm curious how that affects your employment. If you've worked with someone who was a registered sex offender, what were your thoughts about that? And did this come up in conversations with management? Did you hire someone on the sex offender registry? How have you dealt with this, if at all, in your workplace? 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. JSK asks on the page, will anyone hire Steven Wilder Striegel after this? And if not, what would that mean under the law? Robert Issa of Duane Morris LLP, could studios just say, we're not going to hire the guy because we don't want to risk disapproval from our other actors?
That would be a form, I believe, of discrimination. There's got to be some kind of nexus. There's a public policy that the state of California has come down with, which is balancing the rights of both sides. The sex offender has served his time, he has paid his price to society, and now he's been released. And he is not supposed to be discriminated against based on past acts. That's a constitutional violation to take retribution against someone retroactively for a past act. So there's a balancing that's taking place. And you must balance both sides of the equation, which means you cannot unilaterally discriminate against an individual for a past bad act.
Rusty in Sherman Oaks, I understand you're on the registry. What's been your experience looking for work?
Yeah, my name's Rusty, sir, and I have found it to be very difficult to get a job anywhere.
So how, at what point in the application process do prospective employers find out you're on the registry?
Very early, sir. Well, it's tough because my passion in life has always been to be a preschool teacher. And this...
Yeah, Rusty? Yeah, you know,
my little sister has got me.
Yeah, Rusty, okay. Yeah, prank call on a serious topic. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. It's a serious topic, both for those in the workplace who have concerns about working with people who have sex offender pass or people who are on the sex offender registry who have served their time but are still on the registry and want to work. 866-893-KPECC. Or the AirTalk page. Marie in Tustin, you're on AirTalk.
I just wanted to say that there are different levels of sex offense. I'm a volunteer at the local Orange County Rape Crisis Center, and I'm state certified to advocate for victims of sexual assault. And we're taught during our certification that there are different levels of offenses for sexual offenders. Somebody who might be 17, 18 years old and in high school who gets caught streaking through their homecoming game can be a registered sex offender versus somebody who is a pedophile caught doing sexually explicit acts or language with a minor. There's also the situation where maybe a boyfriend and a girlfriend who might, the girl is 17 or 18, you know, the age difference is 17 to 18 because in the state of California, any sex with someone under the age of 18 is still considered sex with a minor. So maybe they might be boyfriend and girlfriend, and maybe the dad and mom of the minor doesn't like the partner, so they press charges.
Yeah.
So there are different levels of sexual offense for those who are registered. So, I mean, disregarding one person versus another, just based on the fact that they have that crime on their record, doesn't necessarily mean that they're a predator or...
Doesn't tell you the degree to which they're a potential threat or in which population there might be a threat. Marie, I appreciate your call. Robert Fassa, this gets back to the issue that you were raising is that the employment context can matter.
It can. And what she raises is a very good point. There's actually three tiers in the state of California for sex offenders. And California is only one of four states that when you are a sex offender, it requires lifetime on the sexual offender registry, lifetime. And that's going to change effective in California in 2021. In 2021, a sex offender in Tier 1, which is the mildest crime, will be able to have his name removed or her name removed off of the registry after 10 years of no problems post serving their time in jail or prison. If for Tier 2, it'll be 20 years. And then Tier 3, which is the real severe sex offending, rape, sex with a minor, things of that nature, they're going to remain lifetime on the sex registry. But the minor ones can come off of it in 10 and 20 years, depending on whether they're in Tier 1 or Tier 2.
All right. Samantha writes on the page, would I hire a registered sex offender? Certainly not under these circumstances. I would never be able to trust the judgment of a man who thought it was a good idea to sext a 14-year-old family member. I'd be repulsed every time I was in a room with him. That's Samantha writing on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley writes, back to the age-old question, if someone's committed a crime, when can they be considered redeemed in the eyes of society? And when can the victims of the crime feel the perpetrator has fairly paid his or her debt? This is a variant of jail is punitive or rehabilitative question. And if jail's punitive, can the criminal ever be redeemed? If jail is rehabilitative, can the victim ever receive justice? You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Robert Issa, thank you so much for sharing your employment law expertise. Much more to come in the second hour.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu. KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows nine high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, we're going to dive deep into the new survey from the media organization Common Sense. 6 years ago, Common Sense surveyed more than 1,000 American teenagers to find out about their use of social media and which platforms they prefer and what their feelings are about the ways in which they connect with their peers. Now, 6 years later, we've got the brand new results and some remarkable conclusions and trends that we're seeing. We'll bring that to you later this hour. I can't wait to dive into it. It's just absolutely fascinating. But first, we begin with controversy over a football game Friday night in South Orange County. Aliso Niguel hosted Santa Ana High School, two public schools, in their football game. And what surrounded the game upset the principal of Santa Ana High School, Jeff Bishop. He made a number of allegations about signage that he felt was racially discriminatory and demeaning to his players and the Santa Ana students who traveled to watch their team play in Aliso Niguel. With us to talk about the allegations and how it's been received by the Aliso Niguel community is Los Angeles Times education reporter Howard Bloom. Howard, thank you for joining us. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got a joining us from the Orange County Register. My apologies, Steve Fryer. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Larry.
Sorry. So you were at the game. You've been following the story closely. Let's begin with what you observed that relates to the claim made by the Santa Ana principal.
Well, I saw nothing, and I walked into the game. I was walking into the stadium about the same time the players were coming out of the locker rooms going on for pregame warmups. And I'm not in the habit of looking for signs, you know, unless something's like really big right in front of my face. It's kind of, you know, decorative or something. But I didn't see any signage of any sort. And the signs that were in, you know, brought into question by Mr. Bishop, the principal at Santa Ana, were behind the student section. A lot of these schools have student sections that are go there and they stand the whole game and they chant and they root and clap and sing and pretty neat stuff. But I didn't see any of this, but I did get a photograph of one sign that was behind the Aliso Niguel student section that said, "We're going to Trump you." And Trump was spelled with a capital T, lowercase R-U-M-P, and it was, you know, the biggest letters on that sign. So I didn't see any signs that Mr. Bishop had alleged in his Facebook postings that said build the wall, anything like that. Elisa Nagel Principal has written, as she said in the story that's at ocregister.com that I wrote Saturday, she said that, you know, any signs that were sort of political in nature were removed by her administration, including one that she said that I didn't see that in photographs or anything that said, bring back Obama. So as far as like any, and then there were chants of USA, USA after a touchdown. Now, according to Elisa Nagel Principal, and you probably know all about this if you read the stories, that they did a red, white, and blue day kind of in commemoration of the upcoming 9/11 anniversary and tomorrow being designated Patriot Day as well. And they said that was the whole stuff that was behind the red, white, and blue clothes that folks wore and the USA, USA chant.
We're talking with Orange County Register reporter Steve Fryers, not only covering the story, he was there. Were you there because you have a family member that was playing, Steve?
I covered the game.
Oh, okay. You were writing the game story.
Yeah. I was there just to cover the game. Well, I was there to write a column off of it. And we had another reporter there, Mike Huntley, who wrote the game story. And I talked to him Saturday after all the Facebook stuff was, you know, being sent to me. And people were saying, hey, how come you didn't write about this, you know, in your column? You're writing about the game. And I was unaware of any of this stuff. And USA, USA is kind of a chant you hear now and then, you know, after the Star Spangled Banners played at high school events, in gyms, at fields, as such. It's not that uncommon. If a USA, USA chant was made like after one or more touchdowns, I don't recall hearing that. But again, some of the chant and stuff like that just becomes background noise when you're trying to feed the Twitter machine during the game and tweet about all the games that are going on all across Orange County. So I didn't, and I talked to Mike Conley, a reporter, and said, I goes, hey, did you see anything? Did you hear anything like this? And he said, no. He's an Elisa Nagel alum and a pretty good writer, you know, pretty darn good young writer for us. But he and I didn't witness any of this, but that doesn't mean it didn't occur.
We invited both principals of the schools and a representative of the school districts to join us. Santa Ana declined to join us. Elisa Nagel has not yet responded with a statement to us. We wanted to get a little bit deeper into this to see, you know, what happened at the game Friday. Were there efforts by Elisa Nagel, as alleged by the Santa Ana principal, to try and racially intimidate the Santa Ana kids? We should mention the demographic difference here. Santa Ana High School is almost exclusively Latino, and I think it's safe to assume that a fair number of the parents of the students who are there are undocumented, at least some percentage of those parents. Some of the kids may be undocumented as well. Eliso Viejo is just over 50% white students, although my understanding is that the team is rather racially and ethnically diverse. Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah, and the interesting thing of this was that a running back named Eduardo Mayen for Elisa Nagel is from Mexico, and he just moved into the area, and he was one of the better players in that game, and he's, you know, just moved in from Mexico just during the summer, and this is his first year at Elisa Nagel High School. So, yeah, they're, you know, it's a somewhat racially mixed group. I saw the figures that you're quoting, Larry, that it's about 59% Anglo, 19% Latino or Hispanic, and then, you know, the rest is a mixed group. So, yeah, it is, what you're saying there is accurate, and certainly covering the Orange County as well as I do, this is all accurate stuff.
Steve Fryer with us from the Orange County Register. Also with us, USC law professor Jody Armour. Professor, good morning.
Good to be with you again, Larry.
So one of the things I was thinking about this is sort of the role of school administrators in this process. Obviously, no one would want to see an environment where one group of students is trying to intimidate or harass another group of students. But there are also legal protections for political messages. You know, my son's high school, you'll see all kinds of, you know, Planned Parenthood T-shirts. And one of my son's friends wears It's Mueller time, you know, T-shirt touting the results of the Mueller investigation. These sorts of political things, I thought, are allowed on high school campuses. Am I wrong?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right, Larry. A famous Supreme Court case, Tinker, Des Moines, Independent Community School District, held that the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of speech applies to students in public schools. The court's kind of very sharp way of putting it was students do not shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech at the schoolhouse gate. Now, there have been ways that Tinker has been limited and tempered to make allowance for other important interests, but as a general matter, on campuses, speech that is not obscene or vulgar or lewd or indecent or plainly offensive, and it's not necessarily at a school-sponsored activity, and it's not advocating something illegal like illegal drug use, that kind of any other speech is given a broad kind of latitude under Tinker. It limits the authority of schools to regulate speech of students on or off campus unless it would materially and substantially disrupt classwork.
So, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Jody. Go ahead.
Right.
Is there a way that an administrator can thread this line? And let me give you a hypothetical. If I'm a principal and I want to say I'm concerned that my students might be expressing themselves in a way that would I don't think would be hospitable to a team that is coming in, and I said, please be cautious about the kinds of symbols and things that you do. Would that just in and of itself be seen as attempting to chill the free speech rights of students? Could the Aliso Viejo principal say something like that, you know, try and discourage build that wall signs or things like that? Or you know, how much latitude does an administrator have?
Yeah, it gets very ticklish and tough at certain points, does it not? It may be easy to say that we don't want signs saying that we don't like a particular race or saying derogatory things that are clearly racist. But a lot of times you're dealing with forms of symbolic communication, Larry, both verbal and nonverbal, that are ambiguous, that can be interpreted different ways by different people. You know, a Confederate flag, for example, can represent racism to some and Southern pride to others. And so how are you as the principal going to come in and impose a meaning on symbolic communication that is itself contestable and up for grabs? And how are you going to teach your students about the limits of, you know, about civility and about being able to disagree with people and to tolerate different ideas, even ideas that you consider intolerant themselves? Yeah, principals and educators today have a real challenge in our current context in wrestling with these issues, Larry.
So maybe the approach would be to find ways of showing hospitality on the part of the school to sort of go above and beyond that might counteract something that would be perceived as negative. But then, you know, that'd be the question of whether the school would want to go to that extent. We're talking with law professor Jody Armour of USC, Steve Fryer of the Orange County Register, and Aaron Kaplan of Loyola Law School. And I want to further, you know, talking about all the complexities of this, be cautious about what actually happened at Aliso Viejo High School Friday night, because it's very unclear that what's alleged by the Santa Ana principal, that all of that actually happened as was described, because I think even he said some of it were people telling him stuff that he didn't necessarily witness firsthand. So, for example, we don't know if there was a sign that said build the wall. That's unclear at this point. But it sounds like from what Professor Armour is saying, that would be a pretty defensible free political speech act, even though that might be perceived negatively by some of the Santa Ana students whose families came into the U.S. illegally. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, Loyola Law Professor Aaron Kaplan, who specializes in the First Amendment. Professor Kaplan, what are some of the gray areas here?
Thanks for having me on the show, Larry. There are a few difficulties that a high school administrator would face in a situation like this. One is deciding, is this message something that's more on the political expression end, in which case it's protected, or is it more on the intimidation end? I mean, in a democracy where people feel strongly about who they're supporting for public office, sometimes those blend together, and unfortunately, with the current political climate, there have been people with white supremacist views who use the name of the Trump candidacy and Trump presidency as a way of expressing that. So we protect political speech in a high school setting. We can limit speech that is intimidating. What about speech that's both? Well, that's really tough.
And so let's say, for example, that someone at a high school football game held up a sign across to the fans from the other side, who are largely immigrants from Mexico, go back to Mexico, held up a sign like that. I wouldn't think of that as political speech. That seems to be a direct statement against another group. But how would the law see that?
The law treats free speech of high school students at school-sponsored events a little differently than the law treats citizens out in the world generally. If you're out operating in the community generally, you've got a huge amount of protection for your speech. You can't be arrested and prosecuted for your message, even if it's a hateful or offensive message. In a high school situation where you've got underage students who are typically there because they're required to by law, and they are under the protection of the school for some portion of their day, we allow a little more regulation there. So we are more concerned about students being a captive audience to aggressive and harmful speech. So in the example that you gave, I think we can agree that the words "go back to Mexico," that's an aggressive race-based attack. So a school principal could take down that sign in a way that a police officer on the street could not.
All right. Interesting. We're talking with Loyola Law Professor Aaron Kaplan, SC Law Professor Jody Armour, and Steve Fryer of the Orange County Register. My question for you is, if you were the principal of either of these schools, how would you deal with what's alleged to have happened Friday at that high school football game between Santa Ana and Aliso Viejo High School? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866. I'm sorry, it's Aliso Niguel. Pardon me, misstated the name. Aliso Niguel. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking at incidents occurring Friday at a high school football game. Aliso Niguel hosting Santa Ana High School, and questions as to whether some in the crowd at Aliso Niguel were engaged in racially charged rhetoric or signage. That's the claim of the principal at Santa Ana High School. His student body is overwhelmingly Latino, the majority of whom have a Mexican background. He claimed that there were signs like "Build the Wall," that there were USA, USA chants after scores that served to intimidate his student body and his football team. The question is, first of all, we're trying to figure out what really did happen, because Aliso Niguel, members of that community, have pushed back on the characterization, but also to what extent administrators can legally step in to try and stop conduct like this if it's happening, or are are kept from doing that by the freedom of high school students to speak. Let me go back to Steve Fryer at the Orange County Register, who was at the game, wrote a column about it and is covering it. Steve, what response have you gotten in the aftermath from the two schools?
Well, I talked to both principals on this on Saturday before I wrote the piece that is at ocrichard.com. And, Denny Christensen, the principal over at Elisa Nagel, said, you know, she talked about, hey, it was a red, white, and blue day, just for, as I mentioned earlier, about 9/11 and Patriot Day being commemorated tomorrow. And she says, you know, what we should have done, we being Elisa Nagel, what they should have done was reached out to Santa and said, hey, we got this event going on. This is our theme. You guys want to take part in this sort of thing? And I think going forward, and interestingly, Elisa Nagel does play at Santa Ana, play Santa Ana again next year. It'll be Santa Ana's home game. That'll be an interesting one to attend, I think. So they just think that they probably should have communicated it better and probably had nothing of a political bent that was in the signage. Again, she says, Denny Christensen, the principal, Elisa Nagel, she never saw a build the wall sign. I've asked for photographs of that. I asked that on Facebook on Mr. Bishop, Jeff Bishop, the Santa Ana principal's posting that's got all this started yesterday morning, Saturday morning rather. And I haven't seen a photograph of a build the wall sign. I just saw one photograph of the "We Will Trump You" sign with the name, you know, Trump being the big word and the T capitalized. That's the only thing that I myself saw. So as far as, you know, what they could have done is just probably, you know, communicated better. Hey, we're going to have this red, white, and blue day. Are you guys good with this? You know, this is how we're going to plan it, and this is what we're going to do. And interestingly, you know, even though it was supposed to commemorate 9/11, there was like no moment of silence after the national anthem for, you know, to remember the victims of 9/11 and the first responders who perished in the event as well. Nothing like that was part of the day or that I noticed at halftime either. So it's
just become sort of a general patriotic theme, it sounds like.
Yeah. You know,
all right.
And I think that was it. But other than, you know, some signs, you know, we love red, white, and blue. And, you know, I guess there may have been a sign that says we love white. Well, you know, everybody's dressed in red, white, and blue. There's a photograph of the Elisa Nagel student section that accompanies our story. And it's got a lot of kids wearing, you know, red, white, and blue hats and things of that nature. And I think there may have been some red, white, and blue themed events at other high schools as well on Friday night, again, with 9/11 commemorative activities coming up. So, you know, I think there's still a lot to wade through here, and I assume I'm going to hear more from Denny Christensen, the Elisa Nagel principal, and maybe some more from Mr. Bishop, the Santa Ana principal. I think they're busy trying to fix this all up today, and that's maybe why you couldn't get anybody on.
That makes sense. Yeah, that they're trying to come out maybe with a common statement.
Maybe a reason.
Yeah, that would make sense. Steve Fryer, thank you so much for joining us. You can read his continuing coverage of the incident in the Orange County Register. And my thanks to legal scholars Jody Armour of SC, Aaron Kaplan of Loyola Law School. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Any of us around teens aren't surprised to learn they're spending increasing time on social media and smartphones. But how is that affecting teens' social lives, self-perception, and their senses of well-being? The media organization Common Sense released this morning its six-year follow-up survey of American teens. The changes since 2012 are sometimes dramatic. In other cases, there's some good news about how young people are adapting to new technology. With us is James Steyer, the CEO and founder of San Francisco-based Common Sense Media, a nonprofit which works on kids, parents' issues, and how they deal with media and technology. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Larry.
Let's start with the increase in the use of smartphones and social media. How big an increase over the past 6 years?
Well, Larry, it's actually more than doubled. Social media use in general has just skyrocketed. But the number of teens in the United States owning a mobile device has more than doubled since we last conducted this study 6 years ago. That's probably not a huge surprise to our audience. And basically, teens today have near constant access to social media. And remember, we're talking about Snapchat, Instagram, to a lesser extent, Facebook. But teens live and breathe social media, and it's having a profound impact on their lives, let alone their parents' lives and all of our lives.
I found it fascinating that 89% of teens now own a smartphone, as you said, more than doubling. What was also interesting, though, there was a slight increase, I don't know if it's statistically significant or not, in those who shun social media totally. 19% of teens just aren't on it.
Well, it's interesting to see that one out of five kids are not on social media. And as the father of four, I've yet to see any in the Steyer family, unfortunately. But no, in truth, I think what you are seeing is a much more educated young person population, and quite honestly, a broader U.S. population and here in California about issues related to media technology, social media, et cetera. I think the fact that you have one out of five kids saying, I don't want to be part of this at all, is a really healthy development, because I think they're making a choice to say, that is not how I want to interact with my peers. But the vast majority of kids are interacting, and most kids now prefer social media to face-to-face communications, which as a parent, and I'm also a professor at Stanford and an educator for many years, I find troubling. I think the big picture is social media and tech are everywhere in all of our lives. The question is, what do we do about it? And how do we also rein in some of the larger tech companies that are intentionally manipulating behavior?
It's funny. My son is one of those one in five. He's 17, and he actually, his friends got him to try social media for a few weeks, and he just felt it was a time eater, and he closed his accounts and didn't care for it. He's so busy, he just felt...
Boy, that's a smart boy, Larry, I'll say that.
Well, but what's interesting is his friends may sort of jokingly roll their eyes about it and all, but, you know, they accept that that's just him and all. I was wondering, because I didn't see anything in the survey about whether, you know, that 19% feel at all ostracized or negative. With my son, he doesn't feel like he's paid a price for it, but I'm curious if some kids do.
I think some do. I think it's. I really do believe that as vast an audience as we're talking about here, every kid is different. I do think that kids, certainly my own children, worry about it being ostracized, because I remember we didn't, like, our 14-year-old is not allowed to have Snapchat or Instagram, which is a total bummer for him in his ninth grade class. And I do think it depends on the environment and the social environment. I mean, the truth is... Media and technology and social media have transformed childhood and adolescence in the last decade. And, you know, at Common Sense, we have 100 million users. So we have a very broad audience to hear from on this. And what's interesting is the varieties of approaches. And your son, I think, is probably in a place where his friends understand that. I think there are other parts of the country and other communities and schools where it's not cool if you're not on social media. I think there are so many interesting findings here to unpack. I mean, one, for example, we've seen all the kids are talking about how there's a significant rise in hate speech and racist and sexist speech now on social media platforms, given the political environment that we're living in. That should come as no surprise. That's a big one. I thought the other really interesting finding was, even though I tend to think that a lot of cyberbullying and negative social interaction happens on social media platform, the great majority of teens said that they did not feel that social media was contributing in a negative way to their social and emotional well-being. That's interesting, because I think 5-6 years ago, when we last did this comprehensive study, there was a higher number. So I think kids are getting more used to how to behave on these platforms, and more used to the fact that there will be trolls, there will be cyber bullies, unfortunately there will be hate and racist speech, sometimes coming from the highest officers of our country. And so very interesting reveal now about where kids and, quite frankly, our society is in terms of social media.
We're talking with Common Sense Media CEO founder Jim Steyer. If you have questions about the survey, which comes 6 years after the first one of its kind by Common Sense, in which they surveyed more than 1,000 American teens between 13 and 17 to find out about their use of digital devices and social media, we're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I wanted to dig deeper into the issue that you were just raising, Jim, about sort of self-perception, how teens think social media, you know, affects their feelings. Because it was amazing to me how teens, for the most part, seem to feel social media makes them feel better about themselves. Even the kids who show up at lower levels of happiness and more prone to depression or feeling lonely, even they found that there was net more positive than negative.
I agree, Larry. That was a very interesting finding. And remember, I run the biggest kids media tech group in the United States, and I thought it was good. And so I've seen it, and we spend more on research than anybody. And so I actually agree with you. I thought they were going to come in with a much more negative response. And you are absolutely correct that for the most part, teens feel better, even if they're emotionally vulnerable teens, from their experiences on social media. And I thought it was going to be something different because as a parent, I've always been concerned, certainly with our daughters, about how they Photoshop their images on Instagram or Snapchat or feel the constant compulsion to respond to friends. And they clearly do see bullying and a lot of other inappropriate stuff from time to time on this platform. But you're right. The great majority of teens said that overall they think it's a positive, sort of healthy part of their social emotional life. By the way, you did notice in there that the same teens said that they now prefer communicating via social media than face to face.
Yes, yes. And hold that thought, Jim, because I want to pick that up. And also I want to ask you about what teens think of their parents' use of digital devices. You asked about that, and the results are quite interesting. Jim Steyer, CEO, founder of Common Sense Media, their brand new survey of American teen digital devices, their use of tech and social media, just out. They've updated their 2012 survey. Lots happened in 6 years. We'll find out more after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little change of pace for Terry Gross and Fresh Air. No book about President Trump today. It's Chef Jose Andres talking with Terry about preparing millions of meals for Puerto Ricans after Hurricane Maria. In his new memoir, We Fed an Island, Andres says he wants governments and nonprofits to rethink how people are fed in a natural disaster. That's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Noted chef Jose Andres with her coming up right here on 89.3. Right now, our focus on Common Sense Media's survey of teen usage of digital devices and social media. Follow-up to the first one they did back in 2012. We went in depth on it then, and now it's our pleasure to take you into the findings, which show some considerable changes. Now, one of the areas of change, Jim Steyer, CEO of Common Sense, just mentioned, is in-person preference for communication. What is the shift, Jim, we've seen there?
The shift is that social media trumps in-person for a lot of teens. And to me, that as a parent and as an educator, that's troubling because I actually think there's no substitute for face-to-face communications. And I think for years at Common Sense, we've been talking to parents all around the United States and certainly across California about, you know, how important it is to have face-to-face conversations because you can get the nuance and body language and the sense of emotional stuff that comes from being in person with someone as opposed to reading a text or reading a social media post. So to me, that's a little troubling as a parent and as an educator, but it shows that, in fact, kids live on those devices. I mean, they are glued to their devices so much. And you, as you know, as you've noticed from this study, there are gradations of how much time kids spend on social media. There's a heavy user cohort that are on there virtually all day long, and then it varies. But I do think that face-to-face communications is critical for important relationships and friends and parents.
Well, and
it's all of the above.
And in addition to the subtleties you're talking about, the body language that's important, Jim, I would argue that Social media enforces a bit of an artificial way of communicating. It kind of slows down the process of the deeper thought being exchanged. And I this is probably impossible to study, but I'm sure curious how it relates to people's intellectual development around more complex ideas.
I agree with that totally, Larry. And I will tell you again, I've been a professor at Stanford for 30 years. And I have seen a difference in my students since the advent of basically not just the internet, but really social media and cell phones being ubiquitous. And I think that a lot of times there's a ton of information, but less synthesis of information in the thought. And there's such a bombardment of constant bits and streams of information and short bursts of response. And it does not lend itself to the more thoughtful, coherent assessment of stuff, whether it's academic or, quite frankly, just a personal conversation. I think that's a big issue. By the way, you did say right before the break, you talked about how much kids are aware of their teens being glued to their phones as well. That is a very funny aspect of this as well, because part of the problem now is the role modeling by adults who also are spending a ton of time on their cell phones and social media, particularly cell phones. So these present just the new kind of parenting and the new kind of reality in terms of human relationships we're dealing with today. Teens seem to be saying in general that they've got it pretty well figured out and they're okay with it. But I think you raise very important and good questions.
Jim, what do teens say about their parents' use of devices and is there increasing unhappiness with it?
There is. I mean, there is total increasing unhappiness with the fact that their own parents are glued to their phones. And so you see the numbers here, and I'm sure you know it anecdotally as a parent as well, even though I'm sure you try to be a good dad about that. But the truth is, kids are very aware that their parents now are on devices a lot. It's not just social media, because by the way, remember Facebook, which started out as a teen and college platform, is now more of an adult platform as kids migrated to Snapchat and Instagram. But yes, kids in general are very concerned about the fact that their parents spend so much time obsessed with their phones. A third of teens total said that they wish their parents would spend less time on their devices. It was a fifth of them 6 years ago when we did this. So this is something that all the parents in the audience ought to be aware of, because ultimately your child's most important teacher and
role. Yeah. I'm a terrible offender, not social media, but I'm looking at news all day into the evening. I'm on my phone so much. And
in a way, Larry, you do, and you have to create sacred spaces around the home. I mean, as you may know and as your audience may know, we have a big campaign at Common Sense Media called Device Free Dinner. And we get $50 million plus airtime from all the major networks about it. The current star of our commercials is Will Ferrell, a pretty funny gent indeed. And the truth is, we believe we need to be creating sacred spaces, device-free meal time, device-free sleep time. One of the big issues for teens and adults is that digital devices, particularly phones, but also iPads and other tablets and stuff, get in the way of sleep. And so I think there are some very common sense things about really just creating space and time where there are no devices. And Larry, if you and I don't do it, our kids are not going to do that. So I think it's up to the adults in the audience to discipline their own behavior about that, because it's easy to just constantly check your phone for news or updates or whatever. But you know what? It's not necessarily a good example to set for your kids.
As our engineer and our producer would say, my head is hanging. I'm ashamed of myself. No, I'm a terrible father.
Oh, no, we're not terrible fathers.
No.
By the way,
yes, you're right on.
Having that conversation with your kids is critical. I mean, and I will tell you, just imagine being the founder and CEO of Common Sense Media with four outspoken children. You can imagine how much grief I take from my kids whenever I pick up my phone for something in front of them. But I think it's good.
Yeah.
I would like my kids to be as aware of overuse of cell phones and social media as they are of putting on their seatbelts. Because kids and driving under the influence, which kids are way more aware of than adults are. And I think that it's encouraging to me that young people think their parents are addicted, because it means they may be able to curb their own obsessive compulsive behavior with devices.
Jim Steyer. Jim Steyer with us of Common Sense Media. Our phones are open. I'd love to hear from you as a parent. If you're a teen and available to call in today instead of in school for whatever reason, I welcome your input on this at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jim, does your survey get to YouTube and other video streaming usage, or is it really around social media?
It's largely around social media, but I think that it's really important to understand the impact of YouTube, by the way, on young people in general. For example, YouTube now is the dominant platform for viewing by kids, like preteens and tweens and little kids. It's amazing. I don't think that the average adult understands the ubiquity of YouTube in kids' lives. I'm not talking about teenagers now. I'm talking about 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids who now, instead of watching Disney Channel or Nickelodeon, are watching YouTube. So YouTube is an incredibly important platform when it comes to the impact of media and technology on kids, particularly, and by the way, this is also true for preschoolers now, because they're by the tens of millions on YouTube watching like unboxing videos where people just open toys on YouTube. It's pretty silly stuff. But YouTube is a very big factor in the tech media world that kids are growing up in today. For teenagers, they just automatically go there to check things out. I mean, I know that when the Colin Kaepernick Nike commercial came out last week, the first thing that my teens did was go to YouTube to go watch it. And so they don't go to TV, they go to YouTube because they know it'll be there immediately.
Yeah.
It's a very important platform, but it's not really a social media platform as much as it's basically like a television.
Yeah, it's an entertainment source. Jim Steyer with us, Common Sense Media. He'll continue with us. Coming up, I want to dive a little deeper into bullying. I think both Jim and I very surprised by the small percentage of teens who had experienced repeated and serious bullying. Want to kind of get to that issue and how parents and schools are dealing with that. And also talk about creative expression and social media, because there are positives that come with the technology too. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3, back in single minute. Common Sense Media is back with its survey of teens' use of digital devices and time with social media. They first did this back in 2012. They're back with a survey conducted earlier this year, which gives us a snapshot of where teens are right now in their usage. You have questions or want to weigh in on this? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Nick in Hollywood, welcome.
Yes, Larry, I want to comment with the way my two teenagers, the moment they open their eyes, even before they're out of bed, they're putting on a headset or picking up an iPad. And I'm about to have a sit-down meeting with my family, because I'm a meditator. I do transcendental meditation. And I'm going to have a little family meeting that when we first wake up, we greet the day before my kids go to school, with maybe a little 5 minute of a little meditation, then go and put on all your devices. But it's very sad to see while they're still lying in bed, they're good kids, and they only do good social media, but I don't want them beginning their day that way.
Yeah, Nick, it's an interesting point. Jim Steyer of Common Sense, any thoughts on that?
Nick, I think it's a great, by the way, as someone who has meditated and done TM for 40 years, I think it's a great point, because I do think it's a very mindful way to start the day. You know, one of the most interesting things that I would urge people to do, and as a parent, your suggestion is spot on, is don't immediately pick up your phone in the morning, before you go to the bathroom, before you wash your hands, before you have a drink of water. You know, take a few minutes and get settled. But you're absolutely right that teens and adults oftentimes automatically first thing they do is pick up a device. I love the idea of getting your kid to do meditation for 5 or 10 minutes in the morning. I think that would benefit all of us. So, Nick, I think that's a great suggestion.
All right, Nick, appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. When it comes to distraction, the Common Sense survey asked teens about that. 57% said that social media use has distracted teens from homework. 54% from the person that they're with physically. 44% of teens think their friends are on the phone too much in their presence, which I thought was pretty funny. 29% have been awakened by the phone in the middle of the night. 33% want their parents to spend less time on their devices, and that has that's up 50% from 6 years ago. So clearly, teens also feel like their devices can be a pain.
Absolutely, Larry. Distraction and attention issues are huge issues for all of us to think about. Again, as parents, as educators, and as folks ourselves, because kids are way more, we as a society are more distractive and have shorter attention spans than we did a decade ago. And teens in particular and kids in particular face that. And definitely it's hugely impacted by devices being omnipresent in our lives. But the whole issue of it goes to your point earlier about short bits of information and people not being necessarily able to synthesize information into real knowledge. I think about that and as a professor a fair amount with my students. But I do think that the distraction attention issues are humongous. Earlier this year, we worked very closely with the two major device manufacturers at the highest level, Apple and Google, to try to put features on the phones to encourage them to have you, A, spend less time on your device, and B, to be less distracted by it. And so we believe that the distraction attention issues have implications for human relationships, but also for your ability to speak and think clearly, and also to feel tense and nervous because you're constantly being pinged by information all the time. Very, very interesting stuff. Distraction attention issues are huge.
I was a little concerned to see in your survey, Jim, that 43% silence their phones hardly ever or some of the time when sleeping. And you know, kids are told, turn your phone off, you know, when you go to sleep. But
get it out of your room. Get it.
Yeah.
I mean, to everybody out there who's a parent and who's not a parent, too, you should have a place to put phones that are not in the bedroom, including your own, by the way. You should have a place in the house. Could be the kitchen, could be another room where the phone is. It is absolutely proven to be detrimental to your ability to sleep. And not just because you're going to get a phone call at 1 a.m. or a text message or a buzzing on your phone, but because it distracts your brain and it keeps you up. And it's a dopamine squirt in your brain. So finding the family basket where everybody has to put their phone at 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., whatever rule you enforce, is a really good thing. I think there are a lot of very simple practical solutions about devices and social media that we could all follow. For example, we have a rule at Common Sense. We have hundreds of employees, but we do not let you bring a device to a meeting unless it's specifically authorized because people don't pay attention.
Wow.
Sitting with looking down at their phone rather than paying attention to the conversation. And I think that whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in school, I ban laptops in my classes at Stanford, by the way, because the kids won't pay attention.
At Stanford, wait a minute, the home of the laptop?
Yeah, too bad, man. They know how to write. They can take notes with it. I always say, don't you guys know how to write? But I actually think that you also have to create these secrets. Bedrooms are very, very important for kids, particularly teenagers, who many of whom don't get enough sleep in the first place. So there are a lot of simple practical solutions. By the way, commonsense.org is full of these for your audience, Larry. You can go there and check out every tip ever thought of when it comes to moderating and balancing your use of devices and social.
Well, I don't know if you can be trusted, though, Jim, because you just said you acted like a dopamine squirt in the brain was not a good thing. So I don't know about that. So you're saying you get actually addicted to the chemical reaction? Is that what you're saying?
No question. There is definitely. I am a professor of law and politics, not of medical microbiology. I will tell you that the same. Look, when we did all the video game advocacy, Common Sense is the leading advocate around those issues too. There's clear data and scientific research that shows the impact of like video games and of devices like cell phones and smartphones on your brain, the constantly pinging you in terms of dopamine and,
yeah,
and other brain functions. So yes, the solution to most of those is put them away.
All right,
get them out of your sphere of influence for an hour or 6 hours.
Wayne tweets at AirTalk, my almost four-year-old recently told me, Daddy, put your phone down and play with me. That was an eye-opener. Wayne tweets at AirTalk, I'll bet it was. Hey, just real quickly again, we mentioned some of the good news when it comes to bullying, and obviously for those kids who experience it, it can be highly traumatic, but only 2% of respondents of teens said that they were bullied many times. 7% said a few times. 87% said they were never bullied. And
I know about that one, though. You're absolutely correct, Larry. But
real quickly,
cyberbullying is a very big deal. And
yeah.
Let's not kid ourselves.
Well, for those who experience it, it obviously can be deeply traumatic and even lead to the most serious action of a child to take his or her own life. So
exactly. And you were just saying here that, you know, 13% total said that they had been cyberbullied.
Yeah.
I found that number quite surprisingly low. I would bet the figure is higher.
Okay.
Maybe that they're more used to it, that they're used to people saying nasty things.
So that it doesn't hit them as hard. Jim, I've got to conclude. Hey, thank you for taking this time and talking about a fascinating survey. We have a link to it on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org. From Common Sense Media, the founder, CEO Jim Steyer with us. Have a terrific afternoon.